You're listening to GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers, now available on iTunes and all other podcast platforms, with new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. GDA Podcast showcases insightful conversations from the best thought leaders, educators, policy experts, motivators, and storytellers on the keynote speaking circuit today. Want today's guest at your next event? Call GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or visit gdaspeakers.com. And now, here's this episode of GDA Podcast with hosts Scale and Kyle Davis. Enjoy.
Okay, so with us today on GDA Podcast, we have Diana Kander. She is a serial entrepreneur focusing on culture and innovation. And normally when people listen to these podcasts, they know that I don't do the whole read out introduction because I'd rather have our guests do that. So with that being said, Diana, please introduce yourself to everybody.
Hello, everybody. I am Diana Kander. I help organizations with innovation strategy and creating a culture of innovation. My background is as a serial entrepreneur. I've owned equity in 9 different companies. I've done all kinds of things. And my favorite thing to do is to make people question their own assumptions about their business.
So when you're talking about, I think that's kind of a good place for us to start. When you're talking about questioning people's assumptions, and I kind of know where you're getting at coming from the startup space myself, but what is it that you're finding when people, haven't challenged what their assumptions are? And then what's like that big aha moment where they know that there's so much more out there?
Like the more familiar we become with what we're working on, the more confident we become in what we're doing. And oftentimes that confidence, becomes overconfidence. And we start getting disconnected from reality, what's actually going on. But we feel like we can predict what our customers are going to do, what they're going to want, because we've been at this so long and we expect everything that's worked before to work again. But people are delightfully irrational and unpredictable, and interacting with them is the only way to figure out if you're on the right path.
Mm-hmm. So basically, just to like kind of break that down, like you're sure. Saying that the old way of doing business of it's kind of like my way or the highway. If it's if I'm selling you a Model T and I'm Henry Ford, the only color you can get it in is black. That way of doing business is kind of out, and now the new way of doing business is to legitimately listen to the concerns, wants, and needs of your customers, and then providing an experience tailored towards that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the my way or the highway. The old way of doing business is also the Mad Men scenario where there's a bunch of smart people in a room coming up with brilliant ideas that customers are just going to love. Well, there are hundreds of brilliant people in the same business coming up with ideas. And so people have more choices and options than ever before. They don't have just one car in one color, right? They can choose whatever mode of transportation that they want. They don't even need to buy a car. They could just Uber the rest of their life. So you need to understand what it is that's actually driving your customers and create products and services that actually create value for them.
So one of the things that I want to get into like your background, but I'm fascinated because I think you mentioned something pretty cool, and we can probably scratch on the surface on this, but what questions are you asking to find out, what's driving your customer? Because I know that a lot of people, when they think about, startups or this kind of agile philosophy or whatnot, they don't think it's applicable to maybe their business or their industry or something like that. But in reality, the fundamentals are kind of the same. So I'm curious as to, what if there's like a checklist or something, like what are you looking at when you're trying to find out what's driving your customers and like their buying habits and whatnot?
So one of the places that keeps having me back is like the National Association of Electrical Distributors. And you would think that that's like one of the least techie businesses ever, right? Like they supply electrical parts to construction companies that are building large scale businesses. And yet this is just as relevant in their business as it is for a tech company like Square. And that is that people are constantly unsatisfied with what they have. Like whatever it is that you want in life, once you get it, you're immediately unsatisfied with it and you want the next thing. And there are tension points in your business that are constantly developing between you and your customers. So the important thing for companies to do is to identify those points of tension, those things that the company is doing that is making their customers unhappy, but also other things in their business that are creating tension for them that they might have an opportunity to solve and maybe create a new revenue line doing so.
Can you give like some examples of like just general tension points that people maybe overlook?
Sure. So one of my favorite companies is Domino's Pizza, and they're really good at identifying customer tensions. And most companies, you know, they spend every day going off a checklist, like what do we need to do to get ready for the next quarter and execute our plan? But at some point, none of that stuff was working, and the Domino's executives decided to stop and start looking for these points of tension. And they found out that people thought their pizza tasted bad. And not just that, like, the actual pizza tasted bad, that the idea of their pizza tasted bad, that their brand had negative taste value. So they would, like, put pizza in a Domino's box, in the exact same pizza in a Pizza Hut box, and found that their pizza was ranked lower when it was in a Domino's box. Like, that's a huge point of tension. And they went to fix it, but they didn't just stop there. They continued to come up with points of tension. So they found that people had trouble ordering pizza on Friday and Saturday nights because those are the busiest times. So they created a way for people to order online so that they could avoid being on a loud phone call where people could barely hear them or waiting on hold forever until a person was ready. And like one after the other, they keep trying to find these points of tension with their customers in order to be able to solve for them.
So yeah, I like how they dissect it, and they really look at like kind of every touch point, you know, every point of interaction that they could clean up or simplify. You know, maybe it's even just down to packaging, you know, something as simple as that can just change the way your customers perceive you.
Yeah. If you think about Domino's commercials, very few of them actually involve pizza. If you look at them, like right now they're airing a bunch of commercials about how they're redoing all their stores because they found that as a point of tension. People didn't feel like the stores reflected the kind of quality that they wanted them to think about when they think of Domino's. So that's actually one of my favorite things about this company that focuses so much on their customer's perspective is that very few of their pizza commercials actually have any food products in them whatsoever.
So to backtrack though, and to kind of help our audience, for those who aren't necessarily aware of you, let's talk or do a little deep dive on your history as a serial entrepreneur and what you've done and what lessons learned came of that.
Sure. So I have bootstrapped companies. I have raised angel investment, nearly $500,000 for one company, and had businesses in all kinds of areas. So software, services industry, and I mean, they were incredibly valuable experience about how to give customers what they want and also how to spend money and time creating things that nobody ever wanted. I've probably, of my own money, spent over $250,000 creating products that nobody cared about. And that was very painful for me. And so I tried to figure out ways to stop doing that, right? To not waste as much time and money, because it was my own money and I wanted to stop.
When you like look back on the $250,000 that you spent making products that people didn't care about, what was like, of all the products, I mean, were there some commonalities? Was it you thinking that it was something the customer wanted, but in reality it...
That's exactly, you know, right.
Yeah, the customer needed something.
Think about the world as like a giant Venn diagram. So in one circle, that's like my worldview, my reality. And in the next circle, that's like a little bit of overlap, it's the customer's reality and their worldview. And we often think that we understand what it's like from their perspective, but we don't really know until we really get in there, right? So I'll give you an example. I created a software product that helped organizations manage all their legal projects. Like inside of a legal department, inside of a company, nobody really knows what projects are going on, where they are, and the legal bills from the law firm don't really help because they just say like what they did this month, but not where the project is as a whole. And so I created a software that took legal invoices and turned them around to where they showed you like where the project was and whether it was going to go over budget for what they were going to do. Like, it was really exciting. And when we were manually doing this for customers, we were saving them like 20 or 50% 20 to 50% on their legal fees just by overseeing the projects in a unique way. And when I started going out and marketing this to other legal departments, like, I got laughed out the door because the general counsel who was in charge of all the legal invoices, they're the only ones who know what's going on in every project. And they thought I was going to create a piece of software that would make them easier, much easier to replace, right? And they thought I was creating software that would give them more work to do, because if projects were going to go over budget, they would now be expected to go back to the law firm and try to negotiate or try to reduce things. And they were just fine. Like, nobody complained about the legal budget. That was not one of their problems. So I was thinking I was trying to solve a problem, but in reality, I was creating all kinds of new problems that they didn't need to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you think about software. I mean, like, so many people play in the software space. I mean, I've been in it for years and I'm now out of it, but it's interesting when people spend all this time, effort, capital, to build something, and then just, it's, you know, the user uptake just isn't there. People aren't using it, or they're not using it the right way as it's had been envisioned, or if it's just a bad experience, or, you know, something like what you mentioned, where it's just making more work, or at least perceived more work, it complicates things unnecessarily.
That's right. But, and it's not just for software, like, it applies to everything. Anybody who's in a sales role, is trying to guess what it is that their customer wants, right? They're trying to push something on the customer. And what they really need to be doing is getting out of their little circle in the Venn diagram and really trying to get curious and understand their customer in a very different way than trying to guess what it is that they want.
So, kind of like to that point, like, what is it that you do when you're working, you know, with these companies and brands, taking your experience and lessons learned, when you're, you know, interacting with the customers, you know, how is it that you're able to then pull on the right strings versus, again, creating a product and trying to force it down the customer's throat?
So I do this really fun demonstration on stage to show people that no matter how good of a salesperson they think they are, they're not genuinely curious about their customers. And, mm-hmm. and it's a great way to demonstrate it. So I have two people come up and ask for somebody who has $40 in cash. And then I'll ask for anybody in the room who wants to earn $40 in cash. And I'll have them come up, and then I have the person who wants the money try to create $40 worth of value, right? Like, they're going to try to create a cash transaction on stage. So they have to come up with something that they can physically do, or something that they have on their person that they think is worth $41 to the other person. And I've done this with, like, the, you know, $1 million sales folks, like the best of the best salespeople. And it pretty much goes the exact same way every single time. So, the person who's trying to make offers, they'll first, like, go with their gut and instinctually, like, offer something funny or just something silly to break the tension in the room. And then the person with the $40 will say, no, that's okay, thank you. And then they'll go back and start to outsmart them. And so they'll come up with creative things. They'll be like, if I was you, I would want to give me $40 for this. And again, they'll fail, and they'll try one more time, and they'll again try to guess. They're like, you look like the kind of person that wants this. And again, they'll fail. So they have three attempts, and usually they fail to make any kind of a cash transaction. And so then I explain to the room that the way that we come up with questions, they originate in three places in our body: our gut, our brain, and our heart. So our gut is like this visceral reaction, like, I'm hungry, I need to put something in my mouth that's going to satiate this need. So I just try to come up with anything crazy. Our brain is like that place of logic, but still trying to satiate the hunger, right? So it's like, okay, if I was the other person, what would I want to get their $40? And then your heart is a place of, like, true caring, where you actually care about giving the other person $41 worth of value for their money. Okay. So I explain how all that works, and we go through each one of the transactions, and everybody in the audience tells me whether they think they came from the heart, the gut, or the brain. And usually, like almost every time, it's gut and brain, right? Interchangeably. And they never use their heart. And we never use like our actual empathy or caring about people in business transactions. So I have the two people come back on stage and I say to the person who wants the money, I say, okay, we're going to try this one more time. But this time I want you to try to channel your heart. I want you to actually care about the other person. I want you to actually like care more about creating value in their life than getting the $40. And what do you think they do?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, because I'm assuming that they're trying to sell a product, but my guess is that they probably just start asking a bunch of questions to learn more about what the needs are of the potential customer.
It is the first time in the entire exercise that they start asking like real questions, caring questions, right? And they ask them questions like, where are you from? What do you, how's your business? Like, what are your biggest struggles? And you actually start getting responses from the person. And like the things that actually end up working are crazy. Like one time somebody got the money because the person with the $40 was really into karaoke singing. And so the person who wanted the money was, turns out, like a really good singer and had their own CD album. And so they sang a song together and they got the $41. It was like amazing and beautiful. But like they never would have guessed that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very powerful example of how we try to give people what we think they want and what they need, but we never try to stop and really listen. Like we hear what they're saying, but we're just thinking about the next thing we're going to say or what we came there to sell, but we're not actually listening to what it is that they care about and thinking about where your questions come from, can have a powerful effect on your interactions with other people.
You know, the at least from my time in startups and everything else, the real push has been towards this consultative selling model that you just kind of described, where it's far more questions than it is pushing. I mean, you know, maybe even in the first two or three meetings, I mean, we say certain things that we can do, but the reality is I'm trying to see if there's still a fit and what the needs are for the customer. And so we may go back and forth, you know, two or three rounds, just trying to figure out, you know, what the needs are before we ever, you know, put together a demonstration or a pitch deck. Whereas kind of like the old school method is, you know, trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. And so I'm just curious as to when you're working with companies and you're trying to put into this consultative selling model where you're actually asking questions versus kind of pushing something, you know, what are some changes that you've seen when adoption has occurred?
I mean, so there's one series of questions you can ask of the customers, right? To really understand it. But there's another series of questions you can ask your internal employees. And I feel like my claim to fame is I had this consulting project for a large company and I made them $8 million like my first day there. And then they just let me stay as long as I wanted. All because I asked why. So this company had a software product and they had this checkout screen and they wanted to increase, you know, how much money they were making in the checkout process, how they could get people to select more things. And so I asked about a simple, which seemed very obvious to me. And they said, no, we've already tried that. We've talked about it hundreds of times. It's a non-starter. We can't even bring that topic up. Like we can't even mention it. And I said, well, why? They said, they're afraid that it'll drive a significant amount of customers away, that doing this is going to scare off a lot of customers. And I was like, oh, well, I totally understand that. I don't want to scare off your, I mean, they were thinking like 400,000 customers would leave if they did this one thing. And I said, well, can we just run an experiment of some kind where we try it on 1% of the customers going through, or maybe like 1,000 customers going through the checkout process to see what kind of impact it would make. And then if it doesn't have the impact that you're afraid of, then we'll try it on a little bit more. And so at this company, they were thinking like, should we or shouldn't we do this thing instead of how do we test whether this is a good idea, right? And right. when they tested it with 1% of the customers, nothing happened. When they tested it, like nothing bad happened. When they tested it with 5%, nothing bad happened. And in the course of a year, the company ended up making $8 million more just by making like a teeny tiny change that they refused to even talk about until, you know, I started harassing them about why that was.
Yeah, it's funny. Like people get kind of weirded out with questions and like, you know, can we ask that? And the answer is yes, you can. But it's all about how you ask it and how you approach it versus, you know, it's not kind of what you say, but how you say it, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, again, I try to make sure that all of my questions come from a caring place, you know, and that I'm questioning what it is that they're doing, but I'm trying to help everybody create more value. And oftentimes that involves experimenting and trying things that they thought could never work in new ways. Because, you know, the competition, the companies that are just clamoring to be your competition in the future, they don't have, like, that's never going to work. A lot of them, they're just trying stuff and you know, they have this appetite for experimentation and trying things. And if you're the kind of company that's experienced success and you think you know how it works and you're just resting on your laurels, then you're in big, big trouble.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I like it. I like kind of what you're saying here. It's like, you have to ask the question because, and I learned this lesson. I don't want to say the hard way because I didn't really, there was nothing lost on my end. I realized that once I handed over an account, being the account executive over to the account manager was then going in and asking all of these, you know, additional follow-up questions to add on to the purchase, if you will. And I was like, man, I could have asked for all of those things and it would have made a better experience for the customer on the front end because they would have had everything that they wanted to begin with versus, you know, slow rolling things out over a 3 or 4 month period.
Yeah, I think companies are so scared of their customers. And that's that's a crazy thing to say, but they're so scared to ask about how things are going because they're worried about what people will think. Actually, like, I understand it. I'm married, and like the scariest thing to do is to ask your spouse like what they don't like, you know, like what you could be doing better. And I feel like that's how a lot of companies think about their customers. Like, as long as they're not complaining, everything must be going great. So I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, expecting the same results to occur over and over again.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the importance of asking specific questions is just huge. I mean, I remember one company, we were getting like to the budget question of like, how much money do you want to spend on this? And, you know, but we did this very early on just to make sure that it was the right fit. Ultimately, it wasn't the best fit for either of us to work together, but it made for a much easier, you know, kind of parting of ways versus, you know, slapping them with something huge in the tail end and just having them go silent. And I think ultimately
wasting a lot of your time. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, like, it saved me so much time and hassle and just, it was better for everybody.
Right. I think, you know, companies will have a lot more respect for you if you have respect for your product. It's not for everybody.
So let's talk about your book. You mentioned that you're the author, or maybe I mentioned it, but you're the author of All In Startup. It was a New York Times bestseller. Can you talk about the book and what came of it and everything else?
Sure. So the book is a business fiction. It is a narrative about all the wrong assumptions people make about their business and their business ideas and the right way to test your assumptions and talk to your customers. So it's all about launching new initiatives inside your organization or as an entrepreneur. And, you know, it's got some sexual tension in it. That's probably why a lot of people like reading it and using it. It's been used in over 70 universities to teach entrepreneurship and innovation courses. Kind of launched my speaking career because a lot of organizations got a copy of the book and wanted me to come in and help their employees be more entrepreneurial in their everyday work.
Let's talk about like the importance of empowering employees and making them much more entrepreneurial versus kind of like cogs in the machine, so to speak. But, you know, giving people ownership of project or allowing them the free time to work on something seems, I think, for many people, very foreign and very like, oh, well, that's what they're doing in Silicon Valley, but it's not going to work here in, you know, so-and-so city in the middle of America. But talk about, you know, why it's important to empower employees and to give them the ability to be their own entrepreneurs inside of your organization.
Well, this might be a controversial statement, but I actually think there's like too much emphasis on asking employees to come up with big innovative ideas. Like just starting from scratch, it's really hard to come up with like the big $100 million idea that's going to save the company. But organizations keep having these contests in order to have like the next big idea. But what they should be doing instead is encouraging their employees to be more curious instead of more innovative. You see, curiosity is like the foundation for innovation, right? The more curious you are, the more you understand what's working and what's not working and what problem areas exist, the better ideas you're going to come up with. But I feel like we're skipping the curiosity step and just telling people to brainstorm big ideas. And the reason it's important to have a curious workforce is they're going to start thinking about what it is that they're doing that they could be doing better, how they can get more engagement from other employees. It could have unlimited benefits to an organization to have a workforce that's more engaged and empowered to create big differences, because not everybody's going to have a $100 million idea. In fact, you know, it's hard for one person in a company to have a big idea, but everybody could be more curious about their work. Everybody could question how they could improve their own skill sets. You know, we get to a place where we're pretty good at what we do, and then we just stop trying. We just stop growing. But what if we didn't plateau? What if we stopped settling for what's been working and we started asking more questions about how we could be doing it better? And if you had everybody inside of an organization questioning their own position and their own skill set, that would be a pretty lean, mean, innovative machine.
I like the fact that you said question everything, like it's an episode of the X-Files.
Yes, but not like life forms on other planets, but like, you know, question what you think you're doing well that you could be doing so much better. Like, I like to do this in my speaking where I have, you know, I'll pick a part that works the best, that gets the most audience interaction, reaction, people seem to love the most. And then I'll say, okay, I'm not allowed to use that next time. I just have to try something else. Like forcing yourself to experiment and to try to find new ways to do what you already do well even better, that's how you go to the next level. And what companies need in a fast-changing, hyper-competitive world is to continue to evolve and disrupt themselves.
Yeah, I think it's really important, like you said, to disrupt yourself. And by empowering each employee to be able to make small changes or to be like their own mini entrepreneur to improve operational efficiency in one area or to, you know, rethink how we do something in another, you know, the accumulation of all those little changes will far outweigh, you know, trying to find that $100 million idea.
Oh yeah. Having like a big competition of like the next big thing. I mean, that is the riskiest thing you can do, right? It's like putting all your eggs in one basket. That's probably not going to work out. That's not how innovation works. Innovation is, you know, Steve Jobs famously said he found 10,000 good ideas that weren't good enough before he found the ones that worked.
Yeah, and I back to your point. I mean, it's just, I think it's such a huge thing that is really kind of overlooked. I mean, I think a lot of people, and this is kind of something that you've talked about a moment ago, but a lot of people kind of rest on their laurels and they think, hey, you know, this is how we've been doing it and this is how we should kind of continue to do it. But by empowering your people and encouraging them to be, you know, more curious and to, you know, maybe look outside and bring knowledge in from other industries or to bring in new, you know, software solutions or new ways of doing something, you know, each little thing that improves something by 5% or saves an hour here or 20 minutes there, at the end, it's so much better for everybody.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Cool. Well, I'm glad that we could agree on that. So, kind of with this book, and now that you have this book and being used in over, 70 universities, colleges and universities, what are some of the questions and things when you're going to universities or to, these companies that use your book as an outside resource? What are some things that the companies are asking of you that you think have applicability kind of outside of just those organizations, but everywhere?
You know, I think my most helpful role has been that of a provocateur inside of organizations. And it's a new kind of title that most people aren't familiar with. So I'll give you a distinction. So between like a coach, a mentor, and a provocateur. And a coach is you set your own goal, and then a coach will come in and make sure you're doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing, right? You're making all the phone calls you're supposed to be making to get to your eventual goal. And a mentor is a person, when you have a specific question, you go to your mentor and they use their own expertise and experience to help answer the problems that stand in your way. Mm-hmm. And a provocateur is a person who asks you questions that you didn't even know you needed to ask, right? Mm-hmm. And it's those questions that challenge you and push you that help you grow in exponential ways. Mm-hmm. So I had a provocateur in my life when I was an entrepreneur. I had this business that I started, and it was going really well. I made like $70,000 in my first year, and I wanted to join this entrepreneurship mentoring program, and I got a meeting with a guy in charge. So I was like, I got this business. It's done $70,000 this year. I think I can do $150,000 next year. So I want to be in your program. And he looked at me, and he said, yeah, I don't really care about $150,000. He said, you could be in the program if you do $1 million in business next year. And I was like, okay, sure. Yeah, I can do that. There's no problem. And like, we shook hands and I walked out. I was like, what did I just agree to? And I wrote down on a piece of paper, like everything that I had done to make the $70,000, all the time that I'd spent. And at my full capacity, working 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, like barely sleeping and eating, I could do like $150,000, $180,000. Like, it's nowhere close. So I turned the piece of paper over and I put $1 million at the top and I started working backwards. So I said, okay, if I'm going to make $1 million, then what kind of customers do I need? And then let me figure out what kind of problems those people have. And so I spent the next year kind of reverse engineering, going to a very different goal than the one I had. And I did not hit $1 million, but I did over $800,000 in revenue, which is like 1,000% growth from the first year. And it's all because somebody asked me like a very simple question. One question was the reason that my business grew 1,000%. And ever since that happened to me, I've been trying to do it for other people and ask them questions and to think about things in ways that they never thought possible, and to help them grow in very innovative ways. So that's probably like my most useful role, that and telling people that they're not actually listening to their customers the way that they think that they are.
Right. Well, because they aren't.
a lot of people interact with their customers. So I had a client, they had like 3 focus groups before they launched a product. And, they're trying. So they had 3 focus groups. Each one of the focus groups said that they were interested in the product. And when the product launched, like, nobody bought it, including none of the participants of the focus group, right? So they're like, what happened? And it was all about how they led the focus group. They were like, wouldn't it be amazing if a product like this existed? And people were like, I mean, sure, yeah, I guess so, And they were like, would you rather have it in red or blue? And so, like, the way that they were asking the questions didn't allow their potential customers to actually be honest with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's also important when you're talking about the provocateur, the person who, really, in all honesty, asks kind of, like, the tough questions that you've never really thought about, because you know, when someone's passionate about something, they don't, the blinders go on, so to speak. I mean, they don't have the opportunity to look, you know, kind of outside. But when someone's a provocateur and they're just simply not passionate about something, they can ask the real questions of why are you doing this? And it's like, why have you thought, and it's not like a negative thing. I mean, so many people want to shoot the messenger, when it comes to like this provocateur that you're talking about, but in reality, they're just trying to help.
Right. And they care enough to be there, but they don't care enough in the outcome of what's happening to like be emotionally invested in it. That's the key to finding a good provocateur, is to find somebody who's like a proven value creator that cares enough about you to help, but you know, is not actually like a team member. That's why I don't feel like, you know, picking one of your employees to be your devil's advocate, like they're scared to death of you. I can't imagine that ever works. But picking somebody who, you know, just doesn't care that much, but cares enough to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I don't think an employee will ever give you the right feedback or the what you really need to hear. They're always going to be in agreeance.
Yeah, because they have too much to lose, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So go find an outside provocateur.
That's right.
Cool. Now, since this book came out and you've gone on the speaking circuit, and you've spoken to all these companies, large events, small events, and everything else, what have you kind of learned along the way, and how is that now impacting the new book that you're working on?
Well, I have things I've learned about speaking, and I have things I've learned about content. So which one of those would you like for me?
Let's do speaking, then they'll do content, because I'm a firm believer in content.
Yeah, so I've learned that there's nothing you can say to somebody to change them. You know, there's virtually nothing you can say that will change another person, but people are capable of immense change if they tell themselves. So mm-hmm. I try to make everything around my speaking not me telling people, but me trying to show them things on stage to get them to say to themselves what it is that I'm explaining. And the first book that I wrote was very much this way. Instead of writing out all the, you know, nonfiction lessons that I wanted them to learn, I showed them the story of somebody who did it the wrong way and then fumbling and having a lot of pain with that, and then how they work to do it the right way so that the reader can actually cheer the person on and know the right answer because they're being objective and they can see it in front of themselves. Mm-hmm. And I find those lessons to be a lot more powerful as a speaker. My like principal concern is that people not only understand the material, but that it actually changes their behavior. And so a lot of what it is that I do on stage is interactive, not like me asking the audience questions, but like actually people coming up on stage and doing these kinds of activities where, you know, if I say, you know, confirmation bias affects all of us and it makes us only look for, you know, evidence that we're right, people are like, oh, yeah, that's a big deal. I don't do that though. And then I bring somebody up on stage and I tell them exactly what's going to happen, and then they prove the point over and over again. People think about it in a completely different way. So that's been my biggest takeaway in speaking.
I know that I said, hey, let's talk about content, but I love the fact that you brought up confirmation bias. Like it is just one of my giant pet peeves. Like I'm kind of one of these people where like, I joke about the fact that I'm always right. But the reality is that I know when I'm wrong, and when I'm wrong, I'm very scientific about something. I'll take in that new evidence and I'll adjust my opinion. I'm not married to anything and I just kind of move on. But it just kind of, you know, when people invest so much time, effort, and energy and money or something into that, the lies that we tell ourselves, the confirmation bias, if you will, is just one of the worst things that we could possibly do as entrepreneurs or anything else.
So look, like one of the most interesting things about confirmation bias is not even that you're like necessarily lying to yourself or not listening to negative evidence. It's that you only ask questions to confirm your beliefs. So, it's very difficult to seek out. So I have this fun game that I play. You want to play a fun game?
I'll play a fun game with you.
All right. So here's a fun game. I have a series of three numbers, mm-hmm. and there's a rule that they have in common. Okay. and you're going to try to guess the rule.
Okay.
You ever played this game before?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, this should be super fun. Okay, so the numbers are 2, 4, and 8.
Okay.
Now, you can either guess the rule, or you can give me another 3 numbers, and I'll tell you whether or not they fit the rule.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the easy thing for people to do would say 3, 6, 9, but my guess is that you choose numbers that, you know, double. So if it's 2 times 2 is 4, and then 2 times 4 is 8. So then the next number would be 16.
Okay, so the 3 numbers you're guessing are?
Well, I kind of went both routes.
What the rule is.
I was guessing what the rule is that everything doubles.
That is not the rule.
Okay.
So would you like to guess three numbers? And then I'll tell you, yeah, whether or not they fit the rule.
Then 3, 6, 9.
That fits the rule.
That fits the rule?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Is that... So I'm like, I kind of know what it is, but I don't know what the words are to explain it. So if you could explain...
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. No, you go ahead and explain it.
Well, like I said, I'm at a loss for words right now. But if it's 2, 4, 8, I mean, it's like, why am I forgetting what the word? It's like triples. It's like everything's doubled times like the three. Like I don't know.
Saying it's like a multiple of the original number.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the rule.
That's not the rule. Oh, okay, nope. Sorry. See, I was a history major, not a math major.
No, that's all right. I went to law school so that we could avoid all math questions. So I actually have a calculator in front of me just in case you give me some big numbers.
Okay, so what's the rule?
No. I'm going to make you guess one more time.
Well, if it's 2, 4, 8, everything can be divided evenly in half. Well, that's not going to be a rule.
Well, give me 3 numbers. Give me 3 numbers.
Well, I said 3, 6, 9. And so then, I don't know, what would be another one? Like, I don't know.
Just give me 3 numbers.
Just general 3 numbers?
No, but ones that you think might work.
Ones that I think might work?
It will help you answer the question.
Uh, 12, 15, 18.
Oh, interesting. That fits the rule.
So then everything's a multiple of like 3 if we go that route.
That is not the rule. And I will let you off the hook.
Okay.
I will tell you, I don't want to give away what the rule actually is.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because I don't want people listening. There's so many people listening, I don't want the magic to get out. But, all right, I'll tell you. It's very simple. Each number has to be bigger than the previous number.
That's it?
Oh, my God, that's so simple, right?
So I could have done 1, 2, 3?
But here's the most powerful thing about the exercise, right? So mm-hmm. We started it by talking about confirmation bias. And you were like, I hate confirmation bias. I look for it. And then I say, the magic thing about confirmation bias is that we only look for evidence to support what we believe, right? And then you only guessed things that supported what you believed. Like, at no point were you like, well, I think it's double, so let me guess the opposite, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me guess 10, 5, 2,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like if you even think about guessing like that, it just feels so awkward. Right, like, why would I ever try to disprove what it is that I'm saying? And it's coming up with ways to actually be about whether or not that you're right, and maybe even trying to disprove yourself. That's how we figure out whether an idea is a good idea or worth pursuing or whether we're on the right track. And it's just like the most unnatural, like, thing to do. That's how we fight confirmation bias, is that we look for negative evidence, and nobody ever looks for negative evidence.
I like it. It's also hard to prove a negative, but it's not. It's not. I like it. That's good. When so we talked about confirmation bias, but one of the things that you mentioned before was, you know, the differences between things you learned while you were speaking, then also when it came to content. What were your thoughts on that, on content?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of people were interviewing customers, and they thought that they were interviewing customers to test their assumptions, but they were leading them. Like I gave you the example of the three focus groups where they asked them questions, but they asked them leading questions. So the second book that I'm working on is on what it means to be genuinely curious about your customers, about your work, and how to continuously work to improve it. How to never settle, even when things are going well, so that you never peak, so that you never start going downhill in your workplace.
And so when you're talking about like how to never settle, and I always like my phrase is choose growth, because if you're not growing, you're dying.
Yes.
You know, what is it like to, you know, kind of embrace that philosophy, and not just in personal development and, you know, one's guiding philosophy and how they run their business, but also, you know, how they, you know, help their customers grow as well. You know, what are some kind of takeaways that you're seeing now to kind of tease the book, so to speak?
Yeah. So like I told you, I believe that curiosity is the centerpiece to innovation, and that most people like overlook it. And it's also the secret to continuous growth. So most people, once they experience, like, nothing kills curiosity like success. Nothing. You know, because once you find something that's working, you're just like, good, I'll just keep doing this over and over again. And so how do you push yourself to stay curious and to continue experimenting and pushing the boundaries? Because that's the only way that you're going to grow and get better. And you have to create things in your life to outsmart yourself, basically, because your natural place is to get comfortable. And you're certainly not going to innovate from a place of comfort.
Nope. And I think that's kind of a, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. Look, yeah, don't be comfortable, people. Just don't do it. Cool. Well, hey, if the listeners, if y'all want to have Diana Kander come and speak at your next event, you can do so by contacting GDA Speakers. The number is 214-20. Oh, that's my cell phone number. But we're not going to give that one out. 214-420-1999. The website's gdaspeakers.com. For the transcript and the ability to buy Diana's previous book, All in Startup, you can go to gdapodcast.com. With that being said, Diana, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity and for letting me put you on the spot in front of all the people that you know so well.
Well, I can deal with it.
You were fun. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers. If you're interested in booking today's guest, visit GDA Speakers at gdaspeakers.com or call 214-420-1999. Visit gdapodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter to stay up to date and be informed of new episodes, blog posts, and more. Be sure to follow GDA Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at GDA Podcast, as well as Facebook at facebook.com/GDA Podcast. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more from GDA Podcast and GDA Speakers.